everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Movie Chatter. This is October 15th. We are halfway through the month of October and just beginning our horror movies for people who don't like horror movies. So we have a lot of catching up to do. This first episode, we are going to tackle one of my all-time favorite movies, regardless of genre. And I'm going to see what my co-hosts Lou and Robin think of this movie. But more on that in a few minutes. Robin, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good.
All right. Lou, what about you?
I'm doing very good.
Okay. This is going to be a fun episode, I think.
So, I think so.
For those who haven't been keeping up, a little bit of housekeeping here, because at the last episode, we talked a little bit about the movies we wanted to cover in this 2019 version of this. We did this again last year, so you might want to go back and hit October of 2018. And catch the movies we covered then. But this time around, we've got a list of movies that include, we did Dark City. We did 1408. We're going to do Zombieland. What else did we talk about? Cube.
Oh, yeah.
We mentioned Don't Breathe. I don't know if we're going to cover that or not. But there's a movie that I think is a good movie for people who don't like horror movies. I think Robin's going to hate it. I think Lou might appreciate it. Have you seen This Is the End?
I have seen most of it.
Okay, Robin, I say it is a compliment in that I say that I don't think you're going to like it. Because it is a very... So here's the premise. The two main characters are Seth Rogen... I didn't say actors. I said characters.
Oh, okay.
Seth Rogen. This is the end. I'm pulling it up now.
I'm looking it up.
Yep. James Franco. Who else? I think Jonah Hill. Yeah, Jonah Hill. Yep. Jay Baruchel. Danny McBride. Craig Robinson from The Office. Michael Cera. Emma Watson. Mindy Kaling. There's like a whole list of celebrities. They play themselves in Hollywood. And... they're throwing this house party. I think it's at James Franco's house. And the rapture happens. Like the actual biblical rapture. Like the Christians get pulled up into heaven and everybody else on earth is dealing with like volcanoes and demons and monsters and all this kind of stuff. So it's them trying to get through the first night of the rapture. You should watch the trailer. But we'll do that later. So tonight, we're going to cover 1408. But I just want to throw that out there. I want to add This Is the End to the list.
No. I thought we were doing both 1408 and Dark City.
That's true. We are also doing Dark City.
Because I have a thing.
I should pull that up here. Okay, so I know that I like both movies, though I will admit Dark City has maybe not aged quite as well as I would have liked. Lou.
Or at all.
Lou, I believe, saw it back around the time it came out.
Yeah, I've seen that, you know, in the past when it was, you know, new and fresh.
Yeah.
And I saw it again recently, and I think you're right. It didn't age as well as I would have liked.
It's one of those things where it's kind of like watching the A-Team from my childhood. I loved that show, and then I catch it on cable now. It's like, oh, my gosh, what happened?
Well, you know, I think some of it is the actors have gotten better with their craft, too. I mean, I look at Kiefer Sutherland, and it's like, I mean, his portrayal in there is okay, but he's become a much better actor than that.
Well, that's true. So I'm going to let Robin kind of take the reins as far as which one we talk about first, or do we talk about them in conjunction with one another? And if so, we need to introduce the movies a little bit. But Robin, how would you like to tackle?
Well, because I have a sort of a complicated relationship with both of these movies now, I think let's introduce the movies first. Let's give the folks an idea of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to stress that Dark City is one of those rare breeds of, and I'm going to use my little bunny air quotes here, neo-noir, which pisses me off.
Oh, I did not know that Robin had an aversion to that genre.
No, I love film noir. I love film noir. I watch Noir Alley. Like we record it and, you know, we drool over these films. Neo-noir just pisses me off.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That neo-noir, I didn't know that it was.
It's actually not a thing. It's not a thing.
Well, it has to be for you to hate it that much. Wow. See, okay. In that case, I should not have introduced this movie because this movie is very, very thick and dripping in neo-noir. Let me ask, before we get to this then, have you seen Brick?
No.
By Rian Johnson. I've been told, well, it's not really neo-noir, though. It's more modern noir, which is different. This is...
Noir is noir. Yeah. It's in a box.
Yeah.
All y'all stop messing.
I wouldn't even put that close to break it down.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay. All right. So Dark City came out in 1998. Now, keep in mind, this is over 20 years ago. This is the year before The Matrix came out. It's a movie whose trailer billed it as if it were kind of either a sci-fi action movie or a horror movie or both. And really, at its essence, it was kind of a sci-fi, neo-noir detective missing identity sort of movie. It was directed by Alex Proyas, who also directed The Crow, another like cult classic film with a huge fan following. So I was a little bummed out because I went back to listen to the commentary before this movie, before recording it, because I thought, you know, there's some really good points brought up in the commentary I'd like to use to defend the movie. Mm. And it was a commentary done by Roger Ebert, someone with whom I often disagreed, probably more often than not, but the commentary was fascinating and it made me really appreciate the movie in a way that I hadn't before, except I discovered I only had the commentary for the director's cut and not the theatrical cut. The theatrical cut was the really good commentary. The director's cut was mainly about what the changes were, which is not what I was looking for. But much like the other movie we are discussing this week, there were two different versions of this, a theatrical cut and a director's cut. It starred Rufus Sewell, who most people probably won't know or recognize, William Hurt, Kiefer Sutherland, Jennifer Connelly, and I believe that is it as far as anybody that people would recognize.
That's because they all ran screaming from the script.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Somebody didn't like this movie.
I don't know who.
Yeah. Okay. So the premise of the movie is the main character wakes up in a hotel room. It's actually been a few weeks since I've watched this now.
Yes,
doesn't know who he is, doesn't know where he is, doesn't even remember his own name. And so you are kind of following him through this this mystery of what's going on. As it goes along, you find out there are these other people who are injecting memories into people's heads, and in doing so, completely change their identities.
Did you go like this, people?
I did not do the air quotes. I probably should have.
You did people.
My microphone does not pick up the air quotes as well as some other models. But yeah, I'll work on that. So that's kind of the non-spoilery version of what's going on in the film. And of course, there's a big exploration of all this. Kiefer Sutherland's character is a scientist who ends up working with these others. But it's kind of trying to help the main character figure out what's going on. Because what's happening is, as he's being injected with these memories, they're not taking. They're not working very well. And he also discovers that he has this almost a telekinetic ability to shape the world around him, which is an ability shared by these others. And so that's the basic premise of the movie. Now, I liked this movie. And again, I liked it a lot more after listening to the commentary, because he really goes into Roger Ebert takes apart how the scenes were constructed, how the cinematography and the angles and stuff were constructed, some of the different nuances of the storytelling. It gave me an appreciation for the level of depth under the surface of this film and in the way it was crafted. I like this film. I do not think it aged as well as I was hoping it would. It's been years since I've seen it, so I got really excited to say, hey, we should do this on the podcast. And I'll admit it didn't hold up as well as I thought. But Lou, I want to know, what did you think of this movie back when you saw it originally? And, you know, you already mentioned that you agree that it didn't really age that well. But what were your thoughts about it first time around?
You know, it was one of those movies where it had that really dark feel to it. And I mean, dark is in the title, of course. Yeah. But, you know, I like darker stories. I like stories that you don't really know what's going on, that you have to kind of figure it out yourself as you go through the movie. And this is definitely one of those movies. It did not spoon feed this to you at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're trying to piece together, you know, the plot, what's happening to the characters, what's going on with these people. And see, the director's cut had the commentary, or I mean, not the, had the voiceover or not?
No, the theatrical cut had Kiefer Sutherland's character giving the audience kind of a voiceover narration. That's right. Not quite like Blade Runner. This was actually helpful.
Yeah.
whereas the director's cut did not give any of that. And it was a little bit more confusing as to the nature of what was going on, I think, of the director's cut.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that it was, because it's tough. I think the director's cut would have been better to see it first. But having seen it and getting, you know, seeing the whole movie, knowing the whole movie, and also the first time viewing the theatrical release version of it, you got the story, you know, in that a commentary or, you know, voiceover. That helped you out. I think that I would tend to think that not having that and seeing it in the director's cut first would be a plus to somebody who hasn't seen the movie, because it would be you discovering what's going on as the characters discovering it.
Unless, see, I would say that if you are going to watch both, yes. If you're going to pick one or the other, though, maybe the theatrical cut.
If one or the other, pick the theatrical release.
Yeah.
Because it will make more sense as you get into it. But
now, Robin, which did you choose?
I don't remember.
Okay, that's fair.
Because here's the thing. Once you get to the end of the movie, you feel like your life was stolen from you. Because I mean, I get it. She hated the
plot twist, too. Apparently.
Here's the thing. Describe the other movie, and then let's talk about them.
All right. So
let's do that, because therein lies my problem.
Okay. That's fair. So next up, we have 1408. Now, this movie came out back in 2007, not quite as old, about 12 years ago. This is based on a Stephen King short story. And it's a little bit different spin on the haunted house story. This is about a haunted hotel room. So you have an author, of course, because it's Stephen King, and everybody in Stephen King's world are authors, who specializes in traveling around the country and covering different allegedly haunted hotels where, you know, there have been deaths or ghosts or whatever. He doesn't really believe in it himself. It's just kind of what he's devolved into as a writer. And I say devolved because you can tell he doesn't really like his life much. He had something really traumatic happen, and his life has been one of suffering, and just he's kind of coasting through at this point. So he is invited to come check out a hotel room. At a little motel out in the middle of nowhere, but
he is compelled.
He's compelled. In fact, he's instructed not to check out this particular hotel, which of course he's like, oh, ha ha, I get it. Ooh, don't come stay in this hotel room because it's so scary. And he's like, yeah, okay, I get it. You're laying it on a little thick there, but okay. So he goes to this city hotel, you know, multiple floors and all that. And he says, okay, I want to stay in this room. And the hotel manager says, no, that room's not available. So he finds a loophole where they have to let him stay in that room. And the manager, played by Samuel L. Jackson, I should point out the lead character is played by John Cusack.
That's important.
It is important. John Cusack is a phenomenal actor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. He has been in a lot of things. Gross Point Blank, High Fidelity, Say Anything. He was probably best known for a lot of 80s movies. He was also in Identity, a movie that Lou thought we were covering.
Yeah. Because
it's John Cusack in a hotel room, like a spooky hotel room sort of thing. So anyway, Samuel L. Jackson is like, listen, we would like to upgrade you to the penthouse suite. John Cusack's like, no, you're letting me in this hotel room. So he stays in this hotel room, and as expected, things get kind of weird, and I don't want to spoil too much, but that's basically the premise of this movie. And like Dark City, it has an alternate ending. This one, I think, more of a different alternate ending. Dark City's ending wasn't all that different. It was more just the director's cut was structured differently. This one also has a director's cut, and like Dark City, it has about an extra 10 or 11 minutes in the director's cut versus the theatrical cut. The endings in this one, a little more distinct. One is a little happier in ending. One is definitely more of a downer.
You know, when we get to that part of that movie, mm-hmm. I want to talk about those two endings because I kind of disagree with the way people thought one was darker than the other. And I kind of think the opposite, to tell you the truth.
Okay. All right. And that's,
we'll talk about that.
I think I see where you're going with it, too. So
and
the
actually,
runtime,
the film had four endings. Mm. It's just two of them we can't see.
Two of them were unreleased. Well, one is available as a deleted scene on one of the DVDs, I think on the theatrical cut DVD. And the other one was not made available. But the other one basically, if I recall correctly, is he just starts the hour over again in the hotel room, kind of a Groundhog Day sort of thing. So, yeah. Mm. The runtime was 104 minutes and 8 seconds, I believe. So not quite 1408, but I guess the DVD stops at an hour, 14 minutes and 8 seconds.
Mm.
Anyway, that's for the theatrical cut. So that is the second movie that we are going to watch. Like I said at the beginning of the episode, 1408 is one of my all-time favorite movies at all. I'm not saying it's the best movie out there. It's one of my favorites. I love movies where you have one or two actors who carry almost the entire movie on their own shoulders. And especially if you get one, it's really difficult to make that an interesting movie. And I mentioned Samuel L. Jackson, Tony Shalhoub is in it as well. Mm-hmm. And there are one or two other people here and there, but they don't have a lot of screen time. Even Samuel Jackson has very little screen time. He's basically at the very beginning of the movie. And in one of the two cuts, he has a scene at the end as well. And that's it. It's primarily just John Cusack.
It's John Cusack. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I can't complain about. A brilliant performance. Probably one of his best, probably his best performance, period. And I love the concept, the kind of taking the spin on a haunted house thing and making it a hotel room, but also like really freaking creepy. Like he really pulled it off, making this movie just intense.
Can I problematize this a little bit for you guys?
After you tell us your initial in a nutshell thoughts, and then I want Lou's, and then you can problematize it all you want.
Okay, so here's my initial thought, right? Hated you initially because I didn't sleep for several nights. Neither did Tim. And so, you know,
I've never loved myself so much in my life.
Yeah. Eric's like, woo, woo. And we're all like, I hate you.
Yeah.
But even now in needing to talk about it, which means my brain is processing it, I am probably not going to sleep tonight. But here's why.
Score.
This doesn't fall for me This falls into the category of, I'm going to say this, you guys are going to hate me. This falls in the category of Fight Club for me. So, so if I were to watch this as just a horror movie, I'd be like, yeah, I'm not sleeping anymore. But just like with Fight Club, once I started to think about it and internalize it and watch it a few times, like I did with 1408, I start to think, he's externalizing all of his internal demons.
Okay, and so it's but similar
for
to
the grace of God go everybody.
It's similar to Fight Club. Your process of ingesting the movie is similar to that of your experience with Fight Club. Not that the movies themselves are similar.
You know what? Think about it. Think about it. Because right, the Fight Club got to this psychosis of we understood that he was living out of his own psychosis, mm-hmm. right? And if you think about this movie and set aside the hauntedness, mm-hmm. you could find yourself locking yourself in a place where you externalize all of your demons.
Did you notice at the beginning of the movie, and this is not a spoiler, at the beginning of the movie, he is out surfing and he has an accident, washes up on shore, and you know he's okay, but it's kind of meant to make you wonder, is either the whole thing a dream, or is he suffering from some head trauma, or is it a red herring? You'll notice on his bodysuit, did you notice what was on the shoulder?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Okay. A lot of people have never caught that. I didn't catch it the first couple times I saw it.
Now, are we spoiling things now? Or are we
But Lou, what did you think of the movie? You saw it recently just for the first time.
Right. I saw it recently for the first time. Like we said, I thought it was something that it wasn't before, but I'm actually very happy I saw it because I really, first of all, I like John Cusack. I think he's a great actor. I like most of the stuff he's been in. And this was a really well done, well crafted movie. I think a lot of the short story stuff from Stephen King translates better into movies than his long form stuff.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's less material to go over, I guess, but the story was concise and I can kind of see where Robin was going with the whole externalizing his demons. But I also think that a lot of horror movies do this where your fears are becoming real to the point where that's what it is making you scared, not something bigger out there. You know,
true, I mean, but I think a lot of them do it in a way that's shallow and it comes across as, hey, look, see what I'm doing. I'm trying to make it deep. And it's like, they're trying too hard because it's always like, hey, this is the obligatory character that has X going on. And then we're going to use that later against that character. And here's another character that has Y going on and we're going to use it later. This felt different. This felt like it wasn't even his fears. It's his anxieties. Like it's his, the things he's failed to cope with in his life more so than like, you know, he's not scared of spiders or something, you know?
Right. Well, it comes down to the biggest thing, like a lot of these shows do, it's something out of your past, right? I mean, in this case, it's his child that died.
Right.
And that's what is his biggest demon.
So
in
Robin,
a lot of stuff like this, you know, a lot of movies are like that, where the one big thing in their history is the one's going to be coming back over and over again.
Yeah, it comes back over and over again. But honestly, I think this movie is like the opposite of a horror movie because it seemingly on the surface is, ooh, the room is haunted. But it's so much deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And as you grow to love and cheer for and be afraid for, Enslin?
Michael Enslin.
Mike Enslin. I wanted to break down the door. I wanted to, help save him from himself. And it, it drew me in, which is why it freaked me out so much. Because literally, we all have demons. You can't be a human and not have them. And what if those demons gets blown up to the Stephen King It size or the 1408 size? He couldn't help himself, mm-hmm. and no one could help him. All he could do was keep people away from him. And there is the human condition. We're social animals. That Stephen King is freaking brilliant, and the screenwriters were brilliant in setting this up as this man had to isolate himself. First of all, this man had to realize that he loved and needed, and then once he did, he had to strip all of that away to keep everybody safe. Like, that's just freaking scary.
Yeah. And yet, while you could argue the movie was primarily his own concoction of all this, there is still an element of this room seems to, if you look back at other characters through the history of this hotel room, there's something in the room that's causing this to happen, that's triggering this in its occupants. And this may be a situation of their own concoction, but it's still the room causing it to happen. There's still some sort of a supernatural influence going on causing it. So it still is also a horror movie as much as it is also something similar to Fight Club, where you have a character that is externalizing their own, I don't want to say psychosis, because I don't think Mike Enslin had a mental health issue as much as it was more of a PTSD sort of thing about his child passing on, and then, you know, the damage that did to the marriage he was in, and et cetera.
Oh, but he had stuff going on with his dad. He had stuff going on with his own
injury. But that's not inherently a mental health issue like the character Fight Club. But you're right. There was more going on as well. And all of that did come to the surface. But again, he wasn't an unhealthy person. He was a healthy person dealing with some really heavy stuff. Whereas Fight Club, like, that character had a psychotic break.
Right.
Well, and you could argue that Mike Enslin was driven to one, but it was the hotel room driving him to. So my point is, I guess there's still an external influence here in this movie that does qualify it as a horror movie, even if the storytelling comes across much more like it's a psychological exploration of what this character is going through at any particular moment.
But then how do you explain one of the endings? Right. So in one of the endings, Enslin himself drives another character to experience the same type of, I don't want to say psychosis, but the same type of experience outside of the room.
Okay. So you're talking about the director's cut ending.
Yeah.
So this is not a spoiler. There is a scene in the director's cut that takes place after the events of the movie, and it involves Samuel L. Jackson's character, and the theatrical cut does not have that scene. And that's all. I think it's probably, there might be one or two other safe things to say about it, but I think that it's safe to at least mention that much. So again, to me, that felt more supernatural.
To me, it felt like this incident was, again, bringing out someone else's demons.
But it's too much of a coincidence that someone else would just happen to have their bringing out of their demons play in that same sort of way. There had to be some sort of influence common to both of them. Because not everybody has their inner demons brought out in that way.
Well, let's back up for a second. I mean, you know, I think the premise that Robin has is that this is a person having a psychological event that is making him relive these things or go into it, you know, his own head and have this thing happening to him. I kind of don't take it that way at all. I mean, this to me is a supernatural event. The room is a you know, haunted room, for lack of a better term. I mean, it's like the image of a horror house. It's, you know, it's any of these things that unexplainable things happen in this place. And this movie is showing those things. I mean, he talked about all the different people that had different episodes in this room prior to that. I mean, there was the,
unless
the chambermaid that,
Unless
those never happened.
He talked about it, but notice he handed him a book. This was the one instance in the movie that drew me to the Fight Club analogy. You hand somebody reading material, research, to set the stage. And if you hand a psyche that's ready to engage in this level, that kind of material, and he reads it, he spends a long time in the hallway reading it, or at least looking through it, and every single thing we saw he read through happened to him. I really dissected this movie, you guys.
Yeah,
he did the
research beforehand. He had a lot of that stuff in his head before he even got to see Samuel L. Jackson's character.
But okay, then so, he had the visuals.
So it was reinforced, right? At least.
It was reinforced, and he didn't know about the other 40-something things.
Right.
Until he got there. So everybody is setting the stage for him, or he is setting the stage for himself.
Well, here's the brilliance of this movie. We can sit here and have a discussion about whether the whole thing happened in his head, whether the whole thing happened for real, but was still his own creation, or whether it was all due to an external force. And there are specific moments going all the way back to not the opening scene necessarily, but to very early in the film that allow you to use those things to support your argument, whichever one of those three arguments it is, all the way back to the accident surfing. Throughout the movie, it provides you with the ammunition you need to defend your point. It just also provides ammunition to people who have counterpoints to yours as well. And it does so without breaking any of that, that logic. So I think that's one of the brilliant things about this movie is I feel confident the movie is a certain way, but when I step back and zoom out and look at it objectively, I can fully support other people who are confident that the movie is their way. That's how brilliant this movie is.
And that is the mark of.
It's not one of those things where you're like, oh, wow, it could be this and it could be that. No, you walk away saying, no, I know the movie is this. That's what makes it even more brilliant to me than something where you walk out and you're like, oh, so what happened there? Let's talk about, like, Inception. Mm-hmm. What happened at the end of Inception? And you can talk one way or the other and you're trying to figure it out. No, you leave this movie having figured it out. But then so did the other person who had the complete opposite interpretation. That's brilliant to me.
I got to tell you, we haven't talked about the director, and we should.
Let's do that. Who is the director?
It's Mikhail, and I'm going to screw up the last name.
Well, then let Lou do it, because Lou's good at it. Lou is our go-to person on the network.
He's Swedish. Come on, Lou, he's Swedish.
No, I can't do this one.
What is it?
Yeah, there's a Hofstrom. And
there's extra Hofstrom? Like, you know, dirty things on the page that they must have just not erased very well.
You have a dirty name. I'm gonna say Hofstrom.
not that kind of dirty.
Okay, but look at his. So he's nominated
looking
for awards.
Filmography
he
here.
Not only directs John Cusack in this, he directs Anthony Hopkins in another thriller about exorcism. He directs Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone in a 2013 film called Escape Plan. I mean, this guy does this.
Oh, wow. He did Escape Plan.
Right? Huh. I didn't even hear of this guy prior to watching this movie. And now I'm just like, can he do more, please?
I haven't heard of anything else on here that he's
done. No, but
done.
Just based on this movie, because remember, right? Films are what the director sees and, you know, the director's manipulation of your psyche. And boy, did he do a good job in this case. And now I, you know, if it's in the middle of the day with on a bright, shiny, you know, afternoon, when I know I'm going to have a hilarious, you know, evening, I could probably watch another one of his films or not sleep for the next 3 weeks. You know what I mean? And that's amazing. Like, that's a director who's an artist with a capital art.
Well, and let's give some credit to the writers too. We've got Matt Greenberg and Scott Alexander were the writers. Let's see. 1408, Reign of Fire. Wow. And some stuff that I don't want to mention because it would actually not give you the best impression of one of the writers. The other one, American Crime Story, Man on the Moon, People versus Larry Flint, Ed Wood. Okay, yeah. So some decent stuff. But regardless of what else they've done, they did a great job with the screenplay for this. I think it was the perfect combination of a great actor able to carry the film, a director who was able to get the vision out visually, and writers who were able to keep the story moving, to introduce aspects to the story that made you wonder what was really going on. I mean, it was a perfect trifecta.
Oh, and he's also directed Clive Owen and Jennifer Aniston. I mean, here's the thing. I get it. Blockbusters are fantastic. They make everybody money. Sometimes gems like this go unearthed because we're so concerned with the Michael Bays and the, you know, what the guys
I remain very concerned about Michael Bay, let me tell you.
As I do.
No doubt.
As I do too. Anyway, so, and this is a shame because it took my good friend, you know, Eric to bring the attention of this movie to me when I mean, you could say, you know, yeah, Robin hated this movie. I didn't. I was scared to death. After watching this movie, and that means it's a really well done movie. I couldn't put it in a box and put it away at the end of the day.
So the one thing that disappoints me about this and Robin's experience with it and this discussion, I hate to say it, but there are not any other movies this season for us, Robin, that you will like as well as this one. Like the other movies we have slated, they're going to be downhill for you from here. Even like Zombieland was fun, but it's like a buddy movie, like a road trip movie. Cube is really good, but it's a little sophomoric. It's an independent film and it was brilliant for what it was, but it was still like a really independent film. Like it had like a $20 budget. Don't Breathe, I thought was pretty good. You might like that one. And what This Is the End is just a goofy, like not quite stoner comedy. They all have their merits, but I think really 1408 is probably the best movie we're covering this season and definitely the one with the most artistic merit. So I would think it, but it's
not that we're doing it
here
in this, grouping of movies, but if she wants another movie that's, I think on similar part of this, as far as the psychological aspect of it and just being a good thriller type horror movie is Shutter Island.
I love that movie.
Okay.
I got halfway through it, had it spoiled for me and never finished it.
Oh, okay.
Go finish it.
It felt long.
But and it feels and it was similar
predictable
to this one.
Me too. Like I kind of like when somebody spoiled it, I'm like, yeah, I kind of saw that coming from the beginning.
See, I've only seen it once. No, maybe I've seen it twice. Cause I saw it on TV, so that doesn't really count. No. So, and I own it now. I would put that up there, but that was also during the Inception days. And don't forget, I'm still the one who doesn't understand Inception. So I want to go back and watch
we have to cover Inception
just before we do it. because I've seen it a million times. I don't understand it every time I see it. I read about it and I'm like, okay, I can see that, but now I have to go back and watch it, right? Mm. Again, another brilliant movie that's going to keep me coming back. As I learn more about it, I'm going to come back and watch it for those things. And to me, that's what brilliance is.
That's a movie that would be really awesome to have a director's commentary on.
Is there not one for Inception?
I don't think so. Is there?
It doesn't surprise me that there isn't, because I don't know that he would want one. Like I think he wants to not explain it.
I think so too. That's why he doesn't explain the ending of that.
But. Right.
Right.
Because I've seen interviews with him on that. And he's like, nope.
Has Chris Nolan ever done a commentary? I want to say he's done one for something. I don't remember. Well, regardless. Memento. I think he did a commentary for Memento. Have you seen Memento, Robin?
Yeah.
I got about halfway through it.
Didn't like it?
Couldn't take it.
You didn't like Memento?
What do you mean couldn't take it?
I just couldn't finish it. I don't know. I got bored. I don't know.
Fair enough.
Well, that's fine. So Dark City.
Yes.
I don't even mind not talking that much about Dark City. That was one of those, hey, let's cover it on the podcast. And it kind of failed. Like, to me, it really didn't feel like it aged
well. It's one of the things where now that we're comparing it, you know, contrasting it with this movie, it's like, there's not a lot to talk about.
Right.
you know, it's like 1408 is so deep and this movie is good and I enjoyed it. It doesn't have a lot to discuss.
Now, Robin, was there more you wanted to say about Dark City?
No.
Okay.
You know what? No. Yes, there is.
Okay.
I don't think you can classify something as horror that's actually sci-fi.
Aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aliens. Yep.
Yep. Well, all right. I'm going to give you that one.
I mean, okay. That's about as horror as you can get.
But I will give you.
I'm not giving you Dark City.
I will give you the fact that it's so rare as, you know, to that being a rule that there may be an exception to, but that is a rule. Yeah. And in Dark City, again, it was billed as a horror movie. It's really not.
Here's the thing.
We decided to cover it before we were starting the whole horror movie Halloween thing, to be fair. I mean, so it kind of bled into this.
But here's where sometimes directors and their little in-groups, you know, get like stupid, you know, and that is neo-noir science fiction. It doesn't work. I do not understand
your hatred of this.
Yeah, kappas, you know, and then, you know.
So did you not like Altered Carbon?
I didn't get all the way through Altered Carbon either.
Wow.
Sorry.
Okay.
I can't.
Altered Carbon was good.
Lou is so disappointed. He may never come to the farm.
No.
He just scratched off our
address. There's plenty of things I haven't seen that I know I should
have. Yeah, we need to have a talk with Tim, Lou. Tim liked Altered Carbon.
Know why you married me?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, and depending on how much sleep he gets tonight, he really might wonder why.
I mean, it's interesting. He watched the rest of that on his own.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, I think 1408 is definitely a strong recommendation. Now, Lou, you wanted to talk about the endings a little bit, and this is going to be a little bit tricky without spoiling it, but I can I think we can say this much. Are we concerned about spoilings?
I thought we were spoiling stuff that we talked about on this show because we're expecting people to have seen it before they listen to us talk about them.
We have to kind of give a little bit of consideration that we are also recommending movies to, like, Robin would not have seen this movie.
Yeah.
If I hadn't recommended it to her. So if somebody listening to this podcast and they haven't seen it yet, I don't want to cause them to do that. But we can say, you know, if we're pretty much at the end of the conversation, we can say, listen, you can duck out at this point if you want.
Yeah, but I was going to say, whatever we think we're ready to, like, this is the last thing we'll talk about.
Before we do that, are there things that you can say about the difference in the endings without spoiling it? I mean, so it's pretty safe to say that you don't know whether the main character is going to live or die, right? So I'm going to give a somewhat of a spoiler, but like people hypersensitive to spoilers should duck out now. If you're not hypersensitive, I'm not going to ruin the movie for you, but it's not unreasonable to assume that there could be one ending where the character lives and one ending where the character dies.
Well, I want people to duck out now because I need your guys' help on these spoilers, and I want to be able to talk frankly.
Okay,
and to have an intellectual conversation.
We'll do that then. I will say that so the director's cut had a darker ending. The studio went back and said, listen, it's not, the ending's not testing all that great. Can we do something to make the ending a little less dark? So they came out with the theatrical cut. If you're wondering which one to watch, I think the director's cut is probably a little bit stronger movie because of the extra content. However, I liked the I liked the theatrical cut's ending better. And to me, it felt more satisfying. Other people thought the director's cut was more satisfying, but it's definitely darker. So I'll leave it at that. We are going to spoil this wide open right now, at least the difference between the two endings. If you haven't seen the movie, this is your last chance to duck out. And if that's the case, we are not offended. We will see you next episode, in which we will be covering one of the movies we mentioned earlier, probably. We haven't decided which yet. So check the show notes for your homework for next week, because we'll include it in the show notes. So
that's your punishment for ducking out, by the way.
That's your punishment for ducking out. You have to go back and look again and figure out what it is we're going to cover next week, so you can watch it in advance. So I still vote for either Zombieland, because Zombieland 2 is coming out, or This Is the End, just because it's light and fluffy. And sometimes we just need goofy silliness in our lives, and that's
let's
it.
Let's do Zombieland.
Let's do Zombieland. Okay.
Yeah, Zombieland's got enough light and fluffy in it that makes
The pacing, going back and watching it, not quite what I remembered it to be, but we'll do that. I'm going to make you guys watch This Is the End, though. Just saying.
Zombie Kill of the Week.
All right. So, time to nut up or shut up. The ending for 1408. Lou.
Okay, so let's talk about the director's cut ending first.
Okay, so let's describe that for people, what that ending comprises.
Okay, so in a nutshell, the director's cut ending is, the main character dies. The room is burned and destroyed. We see the funeral. Mm-hmm. And Samuel L. Jackson's character is trying to give Mike Enslin's wife some stuff that he had from the room that was saved. She didn't want it. He gets back in the car.
And he's very much about, hey, he didn't die for nothing. Nobody will ever stay there again. It's okay. And she's like, how dare you? What's wrong with you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Gets back in the car.
And then the other guy that was with her is like pushing him away, saying, no, don't leave her alone.
Leave the poor
woman. He gets back in his car. He's got this box of stuff. He opens the box, right? I think, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
Did he play the video, the set recorder, right?
Yes.
And he sees Mike Enslin's burned body in the back of his car for a split second in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. And he sees a little girl asking for her father off in the distance. And I think you're supposed to believe that's his daughter and Mike Enslin kind of going off forever. And, while that's dark, I mean, he died.
No, you're close. It actually cuts back to Mike Enslin looking out the window of the burned hotel room. And then you don't see the daughter, but you hear the daughter saying something along the lines of, Daddy, it's time to go. He's got a drink, and I think he's smoking a cigarette, which he doesn't smoke throughout the movie.
He's kind of an apparition. He's kind of a ghost image, he saw a ghost out in the room.
And he turns to go, walks away, and fades out.
Right.
That's good.
this is important. This is important. Do you remember he keeps the cigarette, unlit cigarette behind his ear?
Service with a smile. She's getting drink refills on her wine while we're, it's going to be a long night for Robin. Yeah. The whole movie, it's a superstitious thing that
it's a super,
that he doesn't smoke the cigarette.
Right. Because why? Because he gave it up.
Right.
After his daughter's death. This was explained to us. Mm-hmm. He gave that up. So it's important. And again, this lends credence, this particular ending lends credence to my Fight Club analogy. The other ending doesn't. The other ending is the Stephen King horror ending. This ending lends more credence to this. We don't know the limits of the human psyche.
This one is definitely an ending that supports the idea that he could not, that this is your take on it, Robin, but this ending also supports the take that he died in the surfing accident.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been dead the whole movie.
But it also supports the fact that it was a supernatural room when he died in the room, because
yeah, it
now
doesn't
you're
discount
seeing
that.
Right. Because now you're seeing things that, you know, the hotel manager sees him in the back of his car, hears the voices too. He smokes a cigarette in that ending because, hey, he's dead. Doesn't matter. You know, it's one of those things where he's already dead.
Or because he comes along to like that crutch in his mind is resolved because now he's reunited with his daughter. And so, you know, there's that too, but the director's cut ending supports any one of the options you take. It can be the supernatural. It can be the lack of the supernatural. It can be the other. Whereas the theatrical cut specifically supports that it was supernatural the whole time. So it defines the story for you. Whereas the director's cut lets you define the movie for yourself.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of why I think I like the theatrical release better, because it does pin it down to it is a supernatural event, and more Stephen King things are that way than not. So it's kind of how I took the whole movie.
I liked it because it just, I'm okay with dark endings. I wanted this character to win. I wanted him to succeed. And you can argue that there's a way in which he kind of wins in the director's cut as well. But I guess I have my own issues somewhat that made me happier with, more emotionally satisfied with the theatrical cut, even though I think I could argue the director's cut is a better ending. And I think that even the director's cut, it can support the supernatural version of the story while also wrapping up some of these psychological things. There's no question that throughout the movie we are seeing the externalization of what's going on in his psyche. The question all along is whether it's him doing it or whether it's the supernatural hotel room extracting it from him. That's really what the question is.
Well, or his psychological state given the hype of the hotel
room. He might have been influenced and kind of groomed and conditioned into this going. Yeah, right. But what we're seeing definitely reflects back to his relationship with his dad, the loss of his daughter, the relationship with the wife, etc. His own failings as a writer in some ways. Like he does this schlock as is his career. Like there are all these different things that comes back to his own issues throughout the movie. Maybe he was conditioned into it. Maybe it's the hotel room. The movie kind of leaves that for us to determine. But that cut simultaneously supports all those theories, just like the entire movie did. The theatrical cut makes the decision for you.
Well, after Lou gives us his take, I want to talk to you guys about something.
Sure. Well, I mean, in the theatrical release, theatrical ending, I thought that was darker than the director's cut ending.
Yeah. So explain that.
So at the end, maybe I just misunderstood this, but at the end of the director's cut, at the end of the theatrical release, you know, he's with his wife. Mm-hmm. Things are there.
They get back together. Ex-wife, right. By the way.
Ex-wife, right. And yeah. So at the very end.
They're not divorced.
It gives the impression.
They're not divorced.
Okay.
That's right. They were separated. Yeah. He just walked away, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So at the end of that, he looks at the camera because he knows he is feeding into the room and bringing his wife into this story now.
I don't remember him breaking the fourth wall, though.
He broke the fourth wall.
He did. He looked at the camera, a little smile came to his face, and the scene cut.
Yep.
And that was him letting us know that the room won because mm-hmm. it got another person sucked in when... You know, remember when the whole video thing came back on after the laptop was fried and yeah. the room talked mm-hmm. to his wife saying,
yeah,
come yes. on down, honey. Things are good. Just bypass you. Come on.
Right. So let's explain right. this ending for people who didn't see it, by the way. He's in the room yeah. with Sorry. His wife. They're going through boxes in the attic and stuff like that. And she's like, why don't we just throw this stuff away? And he's like, well, you know, sometimes it's hard to just let things go. He plays the cassette tape. And he's mm-hmm. listening to recordings he made in the hotel room. And then the daughter's voice comes on from uh-huh. an earlier scene in the movie. The daughter's voice starts playing over the tape recorder. The wife drops the lamp or something.
Yeah.
So
and the wife starts to freak out.
It's proof that the daughter was there in the room, even if only spiritually. It's proof that there was a supernatural thing happening. And now the wife hears that.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the next thing after that, after the wife hears it and starts to get freaked out by it, it's the acknowledgement of Mike Enslin looking at the camera and knowing that he has done a bad thing, brought his wife into this scenario, and now she is going to share this hell with him. Well,
I did get the, okay, now she knows that this is real sort of thing and the trauma that she's now going to have to face. As like you know, she's going to have to cope with all that. But I guess from the camera angles, I thought that because he was in the background and the wife was in the foreground. And then when the camera goes closer to him and he's looking toward the camera, I took it to being like he's looking toward his wife and we're kind of where the wife is. Like we're okay, in the way.
Yeah, I can see that. But
that's how I interpret that shot. I didn't right, see it as him there was a winking hint of a at the smile audience.
To it. Yeah.
It's but
I thought
smile.
He was smirking at his wife like, see, I told you.
It's yeah, the same I didn't take it that
way.
You're
right. I can see how you would take it that way.
Yeah.
And I did not take it your way either, Robin, but now that you're bringing it up, I can see it that way as well. The doppelganger yeah. theory.
The doppelganger freaked me out. But remember, so there's two thoughts. One I'm going to put out there, which is where this for me is a flaw in this film. I stopped suspending disbelief when the recorder survives the Molotov cocktail that he creates out of the 80 something year old bottle of cognac or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And really his body doesn't. Okay. Really? So Eric, you want to explain this to me? Or
so we're talking the director's cut then, right?
Yeah, how does the tape recorder survive in any cut? Because the tape recorder is now a character. Mm-hmm. The tape recorder survives.
Okay, so
long enough to replay this tape, really?
So looking at it, some possibilities and such. The response to the fire in the room is fast enough that in the theatrical cut, he survives and not with like horrible burns and stuff all over his body either. In the director's cut, he dies, but we don't know whether he died of smoke inhalation or whether he like literally burned in his charred to cinders. Oh, we don't know the state of it.
We know because we saw it.
We saw his body.
We saw his face in the director's cut.
That was
in the rearview mirror. Okay,
imagining of it though. But that wasn't
was
really
that
him.
A projection of Samuel L. Jackson, or was it the literal body? We don't know. But if the body was burned to that degree, the tape recorder itself, in theory, could have survived, and there's melted plastic on the tape recorder, but the tape inside of it would not have survived due to the heat.
Right.
So you are correct. That would have melted the tape. If we go with that, that was Samuel L. Jackson's interpretation of that character, and what may or may not have happened. Maybe Samuel Jackson never even saw the body. So maybe that's him, his assumption. You know how our brain sometimes makes things worse than they really are. Mm-hmm. You know, goes spirals out of control. If the body wasn't burned as badly, it is possible for portions of the tape to have survived. It would have probably been more interior on whatever part of the tape was spooled up. But even then, it probably would not have played in the tape player. You would have had to have taken the tape out, unspooled some of it, and probably even done some pretty heavy reconstruction of whatever tape was left. So it's a stretch. The indication would either be that there's something supernatural going on with the tape player as a result of being, mm-hmm. having been in the room, mm-hmm. or because the room did affect electronics too. So one could argue blah, blah, blah.
Or is it the suspension of disbelief thing that it just worked? You know, it's, you know, but now, take a step back from it, because we said, you know, he survived and he's in the room. The theatrical release, I didn't take it as he survived the fire and got out. He's still in the room. In my interpretation of that.
I didn't. I interpreted it that he got out.
But we never saw that. We never saw anything from that. The fire happens.
We see him in the hospital. Right,
but that's the next thing we see. Nothing else happened.
The hospital.
To me, that's still all in his head. He's still all in the room. So,
no. I see what you're... I accept your interpretation. I'm just saying that, again, there's also a different interpretation. So I guess what I said earlier about the theatrical cut deciding it for you, the theatrical cut gives you at least two out of the three possibilities. But you can argue that the theatrical cut does allow for him legitimately having survived the movie. We see him in the hospital afterwards. We have a reason to believe it's not the... inside his head version of the hospital from earlier.
Right.
This is the legitimate version of him being in the hospital. And the scene with the disposing of the stuff in the attic happens, for all we know, years later. Mm-hmm. So I did not interpret it your way, Lou, but that is a perfectly legitimate way. And it's accurate. Like, it supports that, but it also supports him living.
Yeah, I can see the whole living thing. I didn't take it that way at all, like you're saying. But I can see how it would be. But to me, it lended more proof to the fact that he's still in the room and there's still something going on there, because there was no other explanation given for what happened. It didn't seem to... I'm trying to think back to the dialogue. Did they talk about the events of that night? I don't think they really did.
In the because hospital, he woke up and she's like, you know,
where am I? And
yeah, there was some mention of the hotel in the hospital. I forget exactly how it was worded.
There was two different scenes where he woke up in a hospital, right?
Yeah, one happened earlier in the movie and was clearly, regardless of your interpretation of what the nature of the story was clearly fake. The middle one.
Right. It was the surfing accident.
Right.
Right. Right.
The later one was.
And that was a throwback to the room putting him in that scene, back in that scene in the other timeline, or, you know, in a previous
but
timeline.
But here's what's going to support Lou's hypothesis, which now I see this differently. Again, another hallmark of a great movie.
I'm going to love it if you can't sleep tonight.
I am not going to sleep tonight.
I can't sleep tonight.
It's not actually sleeping. It's not being able to get out of your bed because you're going to see your own demons in the
windows. So we should point out to the audience, because they're going to love that.
My house has a million windows.
It's not that you were keeping Tim. You were asking Tim to go look out the window and make sure that there wasn't stuff out there, right?
I was asking Tim to escort me to the bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what makes this story so great. Not that like you woke him up or something, but that it's like, you need to go put some lights out in the backyard so I can see things out there. So I know that I'm not in the room.
I left the light on in the kitchen because I couldn't go anywhere in the dark, which woke up the beagle, which woke up the husband.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I don't know why she swallowed the fly because Eric said so.
I love this. Okay, so Robin, you were saying that you see now how that supports Lou's theory.
Because, and I was talking to, so I re-described this movie to my my students. And for all of you who don't know, I have students. I have students who take an intro to film class, and one of their final exam is to produce an alternate ending out of a series of 13 films that we watch. So they have to pick a film that we watch together. They have to recreate an alternate ending with a storyboard, a narrative that involves camera shots and everything else. And they have to hook it to a pivotal point in the actual movie in order to play their alternate ending out. And so since this one had four, I explained the movie to some of them had seen it, some of them hadn't. And I said, this has four. And I said, so I'm going to walk you through the four and show you where they attached it. And I realized that as I was describing this to my students, I recreated the scene for them where the doppelganger comes on the computer. And I said, so in one of these alternate endings, this guy, Enslin, is actually a hero because he's trying to keep his wife from reliving the horror of their daughter's death.
Right.
By keeping her from the hotel at all costs. And in another ending, he's being just as selfish as he always was. Right? Because in another ending, he's dragging her into the endless, right? Because the reliving of that hour, because the concierge comes on the phone and she says, you can take the ease, you can take our express
checkout service.
Checkout service, or mm-hmm. you can relive this hour, right? Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want to relive his mm-hmm. daughter's death, right? No, nobody would want to do that. So, but instead, in the theatrical ending, it seems to me that...
How is he being selfish?
Well, now she has to live with this haunting voice of her daughter.
But we don't have any reason to believe that he was aware that that was on the tape.
Or he's still in the hotel room and he
So there are two interpretations. One is that he's still in the room. Yeah. So
still in the room and he brought her there with him.
Well, or he's imagining her there with him. So if he's still in the room, could he have brought her into the room?
You know, I don't know. He tried to bring the electrician in the room, and
but that was more literal.
Wouldn't right. cross the threshold, right?
See, to me, if we go with this interpretation that he's still in the room, he's imagining all kinds of things in the room that never occurred, like the post office earlier in mm-hmm. the movie, and being in the hospital from the mm-hmm. surfing accident, etc. So, to me, if he's still in the room, my interpretation would be she's not literally there with him; he's imagining her there with him. But if you go with the other theory that he made it out alive, then I took it to be that, like, he's not intentionally getting her to listen to the daughter on the tape. Otherwise he would have been physically closer to her in the room to make sure she could hear it more clearly. He probably would have been addressing her in some way, like, here, you know, listen to this or something. Kind of the statement that he just made to her about, you know, sometimes it's just hard to let go of things, or however he worded it. He's playing it for himself. He doesn't know that the daughter's on the tape. And again, he kind of looks up at her and smirks like, see, I wasn't crazy all along. It really happened.
Okay.
Yeah, but she never brought that up, though. She never brought up what happened, the events in the room. Well, so it was never discussed after that.
So what? I don't understand why that matters.
Because he called her. She actually made contact with him.
Because the room sucked her in now.
I think we're talking about two different things. Yeah, he called her and the room tried to suck her in. Yeah.
No,
what does that have to do with whether or not
remember, he called her the first time and they got somehow disconnected.
Well, the
something
sprinklers
happened.
Went off yeah, and yeah, the yeah. laptop
I don't understand
out.
How that has right. anything the, to do with what I'm... I don't understand how any of that is. I understand how that's relevant if you go with the he's still in the room theory. I'm saying if you go with the he's still alive theory, what does that have to do with anything?
Doesn't, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
So here's the ending I wanted to see that we can't see unless Eric works magic.
It was never released. So it to be clear, the one from the puppets. Deleted scene in the... Yeah, we're not talking the magic air quotes either. The deleted scene from the DVD, which I must have seen at some point, but my DVDs are in my attic or something. That was a variation of the director's cut, and it was included on the theatrical cut DVD release. The fourth one is him waking up back in the room at the beginning of the hour again, and the clock's back to 60 minutes and counting down. Very Stephen King-ish.
That is not described in what I read.
Okay. So there are different things in different places on the internet, and we're never going to know what... We're never going to see that one. What is the one that you have, Robin?
So the one I'm reading, I read about, which intrigued me. And then as I watched this movie again, was thinking about was that he dies. And Olin goes to the Samuel L. Jackson's character. Olin goes to instead of the funeral scene, Olin just remarks, "Well done, Enslin. Well done."
I thought that was the deleted scene that's on the DVD.
Well, keep as going. They're sorting through his effects, Sam, the publicist, says, well, at least he went out in a blaze. She gives him that same disapproving look that she gave him in the theatrical cut. But then Sam, the publicist, reads the story written from the audio from the tape recorder. And then as it's described on the internet, Sam's office door slams shut and Mike's father, right, in his line is heard to be saying, as I was, you are, as I am, you will be, which means to me that the horror is out in a Ghostbuster-like situation. And so the 1408 is now going to be recreated in other spaces in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Understanding was that was the deleted scene that was on the DVD.
Oh,
I could be wrong. Listen, again, there's
that
all kinds of stuff on the internet
scary.
And you know, which one's right and which one isn't, I don't know. My understanding is that was the DVD deleted scene. The one that we won't see is the one where the hour just keeps repeating. That what you just described, I think actually exists. I think that's on the DVD.
Because then there's another ending on the internet, which I didn't see, which I can only read about, which says that Mike survives, moves to LA with Lily, plays a tape of Katie's voice, just like in the other one.
Yep.
Lily hears it, looks shocked. He says, Mike stares at Lily strangely. Nothing else is said. And it says that this one was shown in the Australian streaming service and on Netflix in Japan.
Oh, and I thought that then ended up, like, after that shot where he's looking at her strangely, I thought he then wakes up back in the room and the clock starts over. I thought that's...
Oh, yeah. See, nothing is mentioned about that in the internet. That's the problem with...
That's a problem with the internet.
It's a problem with the internet. But this is also right. Again, I'm going to back this up. People, if you are listening to us, even though we've spoiled it for you, go and see this movie. Eric was right. Kudos to Eric. This is a worthwhile movie. And if you have to keep your partners awake at night in order to do it, I think it's worth it. I actually do. They're not that good of a partner, get rid of them anyway.
Oh, there you go. Wow, that's some emotional blackmail for Tim. If you have a problem with me asking you to turn the lights on, then maybe I should just get rid of you in the first place.
You shouldn't be here in the first place. But no, I would never do that because I adore my husband. But this is one of those, again, one of those jewels, right, that remains hidden under, you know, the leaves of fall that you never rake away. People rake away your leaves. Dig it up. Watch it. You know, and converse with us because this is totally a worthwhile watch, unlike Dark City. Just saying.
Yeah. See, the good thing is, as long as I keep throwing out these gems every now and then, I can keep suckering Robin and sometimes Lou into watching things because there's that always that possibility that there could be something good.
Wait,
never forgive you for Team America World Police, okay?
But I told you in advance. Yeah,
that one.
I told you in advance it wasn't good.
I know.
Panda.
You can't even diss Kung Pao Enter the Fist without having seen
it. That one.
Well, and that's another one. I didn't say that was a good movie. I just said it was a fun movie.
So this does, seeing the movie doesn't even want to read the short story. I will say that. I have not read the short story. I want to find it and read it.
Given that none of the endings match the short story.
That's fine.
Blue.
I just want to see what.
I can't stand Stephen King anymore, but I do like his short stories. He does short stories better than any author in his genre, I think. Even though I think his full-length novels, sometimes I hope that they're really big, thick novels, because then when I beat him with them...
Sometimes he gets a little verbose in his novels and goes on a little too long, maybe three times.
He needs to learn how to end them too, because I had the ending for the Dark Tower series spoiled for me. And thank God in heaven I didn't read that because I'd have been so angry.
I'm angry I read that whole series.
I had The Cell. I read The Cell and I'm like, where's the ending of the book? That was the one where I actually thought that my audiobook had cut out. And there was an error. I re-downloaded the audiobook. Then the next time I was in a bookstore, I went and picked up the book off the shelf and skipped to the end. And I'm like, nope, that's really where he ended it.
Yeah, but what about The Stand?
Well, that was earlier in his career, though. I'm talking late in his career, he kind of
lost his books get very long later in his career. I mean, like, the book that I loved the most from him... Yeah, exactly. But I mean, Misery was great. It wasn't too long. It was a good length. It was a good read. It was exciting.
Perfect Stephen King book.
But like, you know, Under the Dome went on way too long.
Stand had things happening in it. And I think as he got further along, he spent too much time exploring the characterization of his characters. And there was just no story a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the thing is, The Stand interweaves with the Dark Tower stuff. So I felt like I wanted to read the Dark Tower stuff. And, you know, it's what, 7 books, 8 books? Not, I don't know what
the
it is.
The Talisman now. Interacts with it too.
Oh, God, yeah.
Dude, I did not even read that.
But, I like The Talisman.
I'm reading this. And I'm like, okay, at some point, he's got to pay off all this stuff in the Dark Tower. So it's got to pay off somewhere.
Yeah.
And I kept reading the next novel, called the paycheck
he gets. That's paid off.
Wait, where does all this stuff come together and explain it? There's nothing. I'm like, my God, I felt so cheated when I got done with however many novels it was. And I listened to them. I didn't read them, in page form, but even so it was,
I only did the first 3 novels and I'm so glad.
Each one was like 30 to 40 hours. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Someone told me, because I love The Stand, to do the Dark Tower series.
No.
And I went, what? After I started, I just was like, yeah, no, I can't do this.
The first one, The Gunslinger, was the best one. Yep. And it was short.
That was the best one. So if you didn't like that one, it just goes crazy downhill from there. The second one, it's all about these portals to different worlds, including our own. The next one, they spend the whole thing on a train. Like, it just...
Yeah, The Gunslinger and The Drawing of the Three, I thought were both good books. And I thought they worked well together. But after that, yeah, you know, like you said, the one on the train in Wastelands, it was like, okay. And then it just got weirder and weirder.
The good thing about the Dark Tower series for you, Robin, is that it would make you appreciate Dark City much better.
Well, here, so just out of curiosity, I should add these up as a point, but I haven't yet. But so on Audible's website, okay, Dark Tower 1, 7 hours. Okay, not bad. Yep. You know, it was a little short for a novel, but not bad.
Yeah.
Dark Tower 2, Drawing of the Three, was 12 hours. Okay, it's about an average novel length, yep. Right? You know, The Wastelands was 18 hours. Then we get worse. Then we go to the Dark Tower 4, The Dark Tower. No, I'm sorry. We're on, what was it? That was 3, 4. I can't find 4 on here. Maybe they're out of order. But like, you know, the Dark Tower, the last book was 28, almost 29 hours. Four was 27 hours. Six was 14 hours. I mean, I should add this up in the Wolves of the Callow, which was a waste of a novel, was 26 hours. I'm like,
wow.
I should add this up and see what I've spent in this, because I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Them's strong words.
But and I'd then the final the, line in the one. Entire series just makes me violent.
But you know
Robin, we'll tell you what happened when we stop the recording here. And by the way, we need to wrap this up.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
Well, let me wrap this up with me saying at 10:15 today, I sent my hubby a text. I said, I adore my co-hosts. He responds, they are wonderful.
Well,
of course they are. Let me end this by saying, or at least my piece of it, by much appreciation to Eric for opening my horizons when it comes to horror, because I generally don't like it.
But I don't either. I really
guys,
don't.
At one point, I do want to harken back to, I want to talk about Frankenstein. I want to talk about Frankenstein in a future podcast, because I like the way the monster has appeared in different genres. Mm. And I'm from the literary and the way the literary was born, and I literally mean born, you know, in a power outage, for lack of a better term, with Mary Shelley too, you know, how it's morphed into different ways. That might be a nice way to close out our season.
Well, we might need to bring Tim on for that then. I'm not well versed enough in it to feel like I have anything interesting to say, and I'm confident you do. So I'm cool covering it on the show. I just, like, I might be more of a moderator than a contributor. So maybe we should bring Tim on. We might have some other staff members.
Lou, are you cool with?
I'd have to do some homework for it, but I'm sure we could talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to make everybody do homework, but
I don't mind doing it. If you want to put me in some directions,
if you want to pick a one of the incarnations of it as a movie to watch, I'll watch it and I'll participate. But. I'm not going to read the books.
Or an incarnation
though.
Of Dracula, or an incarnation. You know, I think the classic, I think one of the classic monsters, Invisible Man, werewolf, Dracula, or Frankenstein might be a nice topic to cover, because not just literary, you know, obviously Frankenstein has the large literary past, but mm-hmm. as they all do, mm-hmm. but in terms of their appearances in sometimes divergent genres, from straight out slapstick comedy, at least with Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman.
So does what we do in the shadows count as a,
yes, of course.
Okay. So that was one we forgot. So I will watch that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dracula, are you sure? Yeah. That's amazing.
Okay. Lou, are you okay watching that?
Sure. I don't think I know anything about it. So.
Okay. Right. So I'll talk Dracula. To you about that offline too.
Okay.
So we'll watch What We Do in Shadows. We still want to do Zombieland again, because Zombieland 2 is, I think it's out this weekend, isn't it?
Soon, if not.
Yeah. And then we also have on the list somewhere, and I don't know that we'll get all of these covered, but we also have Cube, This Is the End, and Don't Breathe.
Okay.
So.
Ooh, you might like Bram Stoker's Dracula. It had who? Johnny Depp?
Stoker's Dracula. Brad Pitt, Tom Cruise.
No.
Kirsten Dunst.
Keanu Reeves.
I've seen that.
Winona Ryder.
The theater.
Yeah. Maybe Bram Stoker's Dracula. What do you think, Eric?
I'd rather watch What We Do in Shadows.
That will be an episode. Because that's fantastic.
We'll talk.
Winona Ryder.
I like Winona Ryder.
Keanu Reeves. I love Keanu Reeves.
No, I remember it was a good movie. I haven't seen it in years, but
we'll talk.
Francis Ford Coppola.
Oh yeah. What was it? Let Me In, Let the Right One In.
I've never seen that. I heard about it, but never seen it.
That was good. And the Americanized version was not as bad as people like to say it was. It was definitely not as good as the foreign version, but
I just bring it up.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that is going to wrap it up for this episode of Movie Chatter, though. I think we need to pull the plug. Robin, I think, is just stalling so that she doesn't have to go to bed.
No.
But Lou and I do. We have to be up actually in a few hours. So we are going to call it for this episode of Movie Chatter. Thank you for listening. And we would love to hear your thoughts on 1408. I know we didn't discuss Dark City that much, but that's okay. I think 1408 was definitely the stronger film. We would like to know what you think of it. You can email us your thoughts at moviechatter@randomchatter.com. You can also join us in Discord and discuss it there. We have a Movie Chatter channel just for such things. If you go to randomchatter.com/Discord, that will link you into our Discord server. The app is free. It's available on your computer, on your tablet or smartphone. There's even a web interface for it. And we would love to have you join our community there and discuss that, as well as many other things. If you'd like to support the network, you can go over to patreon.com/randomchatter or randomchatter.com/patreon. Either one will take you to our Patreon page. And the people who do donate through Patreon, we have, as a thank you, we have opened up additional channels on our Discord server just for you as a way to express our thanks for supporting the network and helping us keep the lights on. Even if it's just a dollar a month, that really goes quite further than you might think. We also have merchandise. If you go to randomchatter.com/store, you can get Random Chatter t-shirts, coffee mugs, etc. We are adding new logos all the time, and by all the time I mean once every now and then. But we've got Echo Base.
Just added one
coming soon. We should probably go ahead and pull the trigger and do one for Movie Chatter as well.
Yes.
So expect that coming soon. Let's see what else. The music you hear in this podcast is Secret Agent Business by Blue Stolly. And as silly as this sentence sounds, all trademarks are owned by their respective owner. Thank you so much for listening. Take care, everybody, and keep the chatter going.